shouted. Hit the backup generator and call the power company. A few moments later, the power returned and everything came back to life. I felt the breeze of the air conditioner on my face. Life was good again. We began to discuss the drug when we were interrupted by Peg. She knocked on the door and entered immediately. Dr. Kramer, we have a problem. What is it? He asked. It seems that the generator is working, but we don't actually have any procedures in place now, do we? The practice had installed backup generators for just such an occasion. They routinely ran stress tests in the back rooms, which required constant monitoring of the patient's vital signs while they ran on a treadmill. Occasionally, they did a thallium stress test that chemically stimulated the heart. These patients had a much more fragile profile and couldn't walk a treadmill without a significant risk of an acute outcome. In other words, they could die if they exercised too much. No, doctor, Peg replied. It's just that none of the phones work. That's strange, he replied. Then you can use my cell phone. That's what I mean, she said with some concern. The cell phones don't work either. I mean, they don't work at all. They won't even power up. All of them? He incredulously asked. None of ours at the front desk, and two patients said their phones are dead too. Dr. Kramer opened his desk drawer and took out his iPhone. He hit the power button, but nothing happened. He grabbed a charger cord and plugged it into the wall outlet. After a minute, he tried to power the device up again, while still attached to the wall outlet. Again, nothing. I pulled out my iPhone, and I had the same problem. It was dead. What the hell? He said. I was in shock. I have never heard him say anything derogatory or mean about anything or anybody. Swearing was so out of the ordinary for him. I became concerned. So did Peg. She got a very bad look on her face. Just then, a nurse came to the now open office door and peered in. Dr. Kramer, she started, I think something's wrong outside. What's going on now, Janice? He cautiously asked. My car died, she replied. It won't start? No, she said. I mean, it just died as I was driving out of the parking lot. Everything just went dead. It won't even begin to crank when I push the start button. It's like someone just took out the battery. Where is it now? Still sitting in the parking lot. The three of us followed Janice out the front door. The backup generator was making quite the racket, but the din slowly dissipated as we left the front entrance. Janice's car was at the far end of the parking lot, sitting in the exit lane. I ran to my car and pushed the fob. Nothing. I hit the button a second and third time. Still nothing. I extracted the emergency key that was embedded inside the fob and manually opened the door to the car and got in. I pushed the start button on the dashboard and was met with perfect silence. The car was dead. Totally dead. I got out and looked over at Janice's vehicle. The three of them just stood next to the dead automobile and stared out onto Kirkman Road. The office sat on a six-lane thoroughfare about a mile from Universal Studios. At this time of day, traffic was usually heavy. I followed their gaze and looked out of the parking lot and onto the busy street. Nothing was moving. Cars were pulled to the side of the road or sat dead in the middle of the heavily traveled street. People were out of their cars, holding their cell phones to their ears and trying to work the buttons. Frustration was already beginning to build as they were all having problems with their technology. Dead cars and dead phones make a bad combination. Several men were pushing a number of cars to the side of the road, while others just stood in the street, looking for someone to come and help. Dr. Kramer slowly walked back to me and gently grabbed my arm. The four of us walked back into the building and went directly to the break room. Dismiss the patients, but let them know that their cars aren't working, he said to Peg. Then, I want all the staff and patients to gather in the reception area in 5 minutes. Peg and Janice split up to deliver his message. Peg to the front, and Janice to the rear treatment areas. Come with me, he gently said. I followed him into his office, and he shut the door. He tried to boot his computer, but had no luck. So he turned to me in his chair. I sat across from him, not knowing what was happening or what he was about to say. Charlie, he started, where do you live? Orlando, I replied, unsure where this was going. No, where in Orlando? Baldwin Park, I replied. Baldwin Park is a planned community that sprang up about 20 years ago when the Navy closed down a large base on the east side of town. The large lake and newly available property were scooped up by a city-approved development group. A colonial-style, 1,100-acre miniature city was created with a planned mixture of trendy condominiums and traditional New England-style homes, all packed into the former federally owned land. That's not too bad, he said. You're only about 10 to 15 miles away. I suppose so. I've never measured it. I just plan my day around traffic. It's about 25 minutes from here with normal traffic. That means nothing now, he cryptically replied. Nothing's normal now. What do you mean? I tentatively asked. Peg entered the private office and informed the doctor that everyone was in the waiting room. Just follow me, he said. We moved down the hall into the reception room. Almost 20 people stared at us when we entered the common area. Please sit down, Dr. Kramer requested. Everyone did as they were told. We have a total power outage outside. We've lost more than electricity, he continued. All landlines and cell phones are out of order as well. In fact, everything electronic seems to be down. What happened? One of the patients asked. I don't know, he honestly replied. But things don't look good. All the cars outside on the road are dead as well. Everyone is stranded. But we have lights here, the patient stated. We have a generator, he replied. Why is it working and nothing else does? Someone else asked. I truly don't know, he said. We had it installed with a lightning protective screen around it. Maybe that kept it from going out. All I know is that nothing outside this building seems to be on. Panicked conversations began as the assembled group tried to deal with their new reality. Dr. Kramer hushed them. Talking loudly, he finally silenced the group and continued speaking. We don't know how extensive this is, he continued. It may just be our area, or it may be larger than that. I would recommend that you stay here until we figure this out. At least with our generator, we will have power for the next few days. Few days? Another patient gasped. What do you mean, a few days? Just what I said, he replied. We don't know how long this will last. If it's local, I would expect emergency services to be here shortly. If it's more widespread, we could be looking at an extended period of time. Just how extended? Another patient asked. No way to know, he said, but let's just take this one step at a time. Dr. Kramer organized the group. He got a list of medications his patients were taking and had us all check the medicine locker for replacements. I volunteered my stash, and he gratefully accepted. The patients were given water and shown where the bathroom facilities were. The cable was out, so the staff tried to put on some old movies over the DVD connection, but neither the television nor the DVD player would work. They all sat in silence as Dr. Kramer went back to his office, and I followed along. After he shut the door, he sat heavily in his chair and looked at me. I sat down without prompting and faced him. He looked both tired and worried, and I quickly realized that I had never seen him like this before. Here was a man that literally held people's lives in his hands, and he was afraid. After seeing his demeanor, I became afraid too. "So what's really happening?" I asked. "I think we were hit by an EMP," he replied. "An EMP? What's that?" "Electromagnetic pulse. A burst of electromagnetic energy that overwhelms electronic equipment. It basically fries anything that uses electricity." "How? What could cause this?" "Well," he continued, "a lot of things can cause an EMP. Nature creates them with a lightning strike, but given the large area that's affected, I doubt that is the cause. Solar flares can cause this as well. We could have been hit by a solar EMP."
"How many are affected then?"
"It could be just us, or all of the East Coast," he replied. "It could affect the entire nation, or it could be global. But that's only if the cause was solar."
"What else could have caused it then?"
"A nuclear detonation would do that," he somberly replied.
"What?"
"I didn't see any mushroom clouds when we were outside," he said with some conviction. "If there was a nuclear detonation and it caused this outage, it would have most likely been about 200 miles up in the air and would hardly be noticed here on the ground. At least the blast wouldn't be noticed. But the damage we see around us could be from just such an event."
I was stunned. Either scenario sounded bleak. 1,000 things ran through my mind. My family, I thought. What about my family?
My parents were divorced almost 2 decades ago. My mother brought another man into our house after asking my dad to leave. In the long run, it was probably for the best. My dad remarried 5 years later and lived nearby, but was up in North Carolina for a few weeks. My mom moved to Tampa to be with yet another guy. She was always looking for something better, playing the victim whenever things didn't work out. I forgave her, but promised myself I would never be like her. So far, I was doing okay, but with my family far away, I had nowhere to go other than my apartment. I lived alone.
"I could use your help," Dr. Kramer said, breaking me out of my trance.
"If you can, I need you to help me with what's coming in the next few days."
"I guess so," I replied.
"I don't have any family in town anyway. What do you need me to do?" He laid out a plan that seemed excessive, but I had learned to trust him over the past 6 years. He had never lied to me or let me down. I did what he asked.
Chapter 5. Day 1. Officer John Drosky, Armed Patrol, Orlando, Florida. Officer John Drosky keyed his radio and reported back to dispatch that he was going to 10-6, or busy and less urgent, to stop by the boy's house on his way back to the barn at the end of his shift. The boy lived just a few miles from where he had been arrested, and Drosky found the house with little trouble. The one-story concrete block home sat in an older district of the city. The neighborhood was a combination of trendy and tired. Several homes had replaced their older jalousie windows with more modern double-hung replacements. These homes showed signs of being well-maintained, their lawns manicured, and plant beds lined with plastic or wood edgers. Most of the open carports were empty. It was mid-afternoon, and the homeowners were still at work. The officer was pleasantly surprised that both carport spots were occupied when he found the young man's home. But as he suspected, the home showed no sign of improvement or maintenance that would indicate a stable family life. It always seemed to be this way. John stopped his car in front of the house, staying out of the driveway. He walked up the broken asphalt
and down the weed-infested concrete front walkway. He rang the doorbell and waited. After a minute, he rang it once again and followed it with several loud and resounding raps on the door. After another minute passed, he cautiously strolled around the side of the house, shaking his head at the weeds and detritus that covered the overgrown yard. He cautiously approached the back door and knocked loudly, announcing himself.
"Hello?" he yelled. "Orlando Police, please open the door."
No response. The officer looked into the window and saw what appeared to be a living room, and across from him, the front door. No lights were on. He retraced his steps, and pressing his face to the next window, he stared into the kitchen. It was remarkably clean and organized. Surprising, he thought. He moved towards that back of the house where he had first walked around from the front, and, shielding his eyes, he pressed his face once again against the pane of glass and stared into the back room. It looked like a large bedroom. The mini blinds were partially closed, limiting the light entering the room, as well as his ability to see directly in. He pulled out his Surefire flashlight and held it against the glass, providing some light to see by. He looked once again into the room and saw two people under the cover, sleeping in the king-size bed.
"Damn it," he thought. "They're either assholes or drugged out."
He knocked heavily on the window, yelling through the glass.
"Orlando Police," he shouted. "Open the door now."
No one moved inside the bed. Not a peep, not even a shrug or turn. Officer Drosky got a sinking feeling in his gut. He knew what he was looking at, but his mind didn't want to believe it. He had to force himself to return to the back door. He didn't want to confirm his deepest fears. He tried the doorknob and found it open. He pulled out his SIG 226 and, using his flashlight, he entered the house, announcing his presence.
"This is the Orlando Police," he shouted. "Is there anyone home?"
The tired home refused to reply. Drosky cautiously cleared the large room and made his way back to the bedroom where the two bodies laid. By now, he knew there were bodies. He slowly made his way back to the bedroom and found two women under the sheets. Both wore hospital scrubs, and their final embrace was marred by an open stab wound to the neck on one of the women, and a stab wound to the chest on the other. Their eyes had been closed, and the smaller woman's head lay on the other's shoulder. Drosky thought of the kitchen knife that the young man had in his backpack. The blade of that knife matched the death blows that stared back at him. He shook his head in sorrow. He hated to make the call to Beth. The kid was going in with the adults, and with the death penalty alive and well in the state of Florida, Officer John Drosky knew the kid wasn't in for a very happy future. John tried his portable radio, but was only rewarded with a busy beep, so he walked back to his cruiser and stared back at the house. God damn it, he thought. Why couldn't things just come out right for a change? He sat down in his cruiser and turned on the engine. It was remarkably warm for November, and the air conditioner would feel nice after getting out of the stuffy, tired old home. Just as John grabbed the mic to his encrypted Motorola APCO25 digital radio system, his car died. It just stopped working. He tried to crank the engine, but got no response. His car had turned into a dead lump of metal. Nothing came on. It was as if someone had pulled out his car's battery. John shook his head, thinking that this was just one of those days. He grabbed his mobile phone and was just as surprised when he saw that it had no power either. He got out of his car, staring at the iPhone, jabbing at the power button on top of the phone. Nothing. And that's when he noticed it. The sound of nothing. The boy's neighborhood was only a block from a major road. Traffic noise was heavy with commuters filling the four-lane road on their journey home. Now, the noise was gone, replaced by birds and a faint sound of an occasional yell or scream coming from the normally congested streets. John ran up to the intersection and stared down the normally busy thoroughfare. Everywhere, cars were stopped. People were out of their vehicles, yelling at each other, both in confusion and a bit of fear, as they searched for an answer that made sense to them. Several cars had collided as they lost power, their drivers frantically trying to call 911 or whomever their closest loved one was. John instantly knew what had happened, or at least what likely had happened. Since 2010, the city had been integrating their terror units with the federal government. All of the officers had received training on CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear emergency situations. The OPD had been actively coordinating their efforts with FEMA's Center for Domestic Preparedness, CDP, out of Alabama. Due to the city's large tourist population, Orlando was considered a high-priority target. Because of this training, John recognized all the symptoms of an EMP event. His initial exposure to this training inspired him to further his education on the subject. Because of this, he was pretty sure this attack was a big one. Not a car moved for as far as he could see. Suddenly, he heard a scream and saw several people pointing to the sky. John couldn't help but watch as a large commuter plane was slowly gliding over Colonial Drive when it suddenly started to fall from the sky, spinning down from the heavens. It exploded not a mile away from him. Just as quickly, he could see almost a dozen more aircraft, some filled with hundreds of souls, rapidly descending from the clouds. If this was nationwide, he thought, tens of thousands of people were dying right now. It was too much for him to take, and he sat down on the sidewalk and silently watched. Armageddon had arrived, and John knew that the city of nearly 2 million had no clue what had just happened. Seeing the metal tubes, tombs really, dropping rapidly from the sky, reinforced his belief that there was little chance that these people would survive the next few weeks. Chapter 6. Day 1. Delta Flight 2181. 3,000 feet over Orlando. Captain Kevin Stillwagon concentrated on his instruments as Delta Flight 2181 was making its final north-to-south approach to Orlando International Airport. The cabin was silent as the captain and his first officer observed sterile cockpit protocol, which mandated no conversation save necessary observations or recommendations, which identified less than nominal events or environmental changes. In other words, the two pilots shut up unless something seemed out of sorts. The approach into Orlando from their present northern flight pattern was one of Captain Stillwagon's least favorite. Their approach brought them near the Orlando Executive Airport, which was less than 10 miles north of OIA. This meant that their approach to Orlando International had to be modified to not interfere with local civilian aviation traffic. This modified landing vector required that he maintain an altitude of 2,500 feet until he passed the Executive Airport, then a rapid descent to the sweet spot of 1,000 feet during his final approach. Originally, Orlando Executive was the civilian aviation hub of the city, until the early 1960s when civilian jetliners began to ply the skies over Central Florida. Landlocked by the growing city, the tiny airport's runways were insufficient to handle the new jet's needs. Fortunately, just 10 miles south, the Air Force had a large and capable airfield, and the federal government partnered with the city of Orlando to create a joint military-civilian airport using facilities military designation McCoy Airfield. For the next 12 years or so, Boeing 707 civilian jets shared runway time with B-52 Stratofortresses and KC-135 Stratotankers. Both civilian and military jets played a critical role in the defeat of communism. The military jets flew 24-hour, 7-day-a-week missions for NORAD as the military doctrine of MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, required that nuclear weapons be deployed and available at a moment's notice as a deterrent to a surprise military strike. The civilian side allowed for the necessary economic growth in Central Florida that led to Disney World and other money-making endeavors. This created a bigger tax base that could support the massive military costs needed to keep the B-52 bombers, or BUFs, in the air. The inferior economics of communism couldn't keep up with the economic might of a free society, and it eventually bankrupted the Soviet Union, ending the Cold War. In 1976, the last military flight had departed McCoy Airfield. The city and state renamed it Orlando International Airport, but to this day, the airport designation you see on your check-in bags has the old airfield three-letter abbreviation, MCO. Now, about 10 miles out, Captain Stillwagon was fighting a stiff crosswind that cut southwest to northeast across his nose. A steady 25-knot wind was forcing him to use his considerable skills in keeping the nose of the jet on a steady trajectory. Having been a commercial pilot for over 20 years, the situation was far from dire, but required some skill to keep his passengers comfortable. His Airbus 320's twin engines were powering them through the sunny skies. Were it not for the crosswind and his modified flight trajectory, the next few minutes would be a breeze. His first officer, Tyler Landry, was sitting in the next seat, reviewing the approach checklist and monitoring their instrument readings. At 3,000 feet and about 9 miles now from the airport, they were getting ready for the final and quick descent to the runway. To their right, Stillwagon could see Highway 50 cutting an east-west line through the city. The executive airport could be seen as well, just a few miles east, sitting just south of the highway. In a few more seconds, they would begin to initiate their landing checklist. Landing gear down, flaps at full and reduced power to the engines. At 2,500 feet, their GPWIS, or Ground Proximity Warning System, would start counting down the feet above ground. In a normal landing, the mechanical voice would be the only conversation heard in the cockpit as they made their final descent. All commercial flights are to make what are called powered landings. This means that no commercial airline would shut down the engines until 100 feet or less above the runway. When these engines are shut down, the restart time can exceed 15 seconds. If an obstacle were to suddenly appear on the runway, such as a wayward luggage cart or vehicle, a powered landing would allow the pilot to instantly accelerate and keep the airliner in the air for another landing pass. With over 30,000 pounds of thrust from each of its two engines, the A320 sliced its way toward OIA when the unthinkable happened. The entire jetliner lost power. Instantly, Flight 2181 went from a modern, sleek passenger airline to an aluminum tube hurtling through the air with about 90 seconds of glide time before gravity brought it to the ground. "Fuck!" Landry shouted. "Engines offline! All power gone!" "No shit!" Stillwagon shot back. The entire control panel in front of the two men went dark. The modern jet was both blessed and cursed with fly-by-wire controls, which means that almost everything is computer-controlled. Older planes and early jets used wires to control the aircraft's yoke, pitch, and roll, as well as the left-right or yaw movement of the plane. In older craft, the cables literally pulled on the flaps to create the proper movement. Now, computers sent an electronic signal that powered the flaps. With the power off, nothing happened. Everything was frozen in the last position that the computer had directed it to.
"Take the controls," Stillwagon said to his first officer.
As commander of the aircraft, he was responsible for the lives of the souls sitting behind him. His first priority was to restart the engines, which meant that he had to pass the control of the aircraft, what little they had, over to his co-pilot. Within seconds, Kevin determined that he had no engine control and wouldn't within the next minute or two, when gravity dictated that they would be on the ground. Their only hope was finding somewhere to set down, without power and with little control of the situation.
"We can make it to the field," Landry loudly said. "We've still got rudder and the trim wheel."
All modern, post-mid-1980s commercial aircraft are equipped with an emergency system known as the RAT, or Ram Air Turbine. When power is lost to the aircraft, a gravity latch releases, and a turbine drops from the airframe. The 200-mile-per-hour wind rushing through the turbine spins its blades, powering a small generator, or APU, auxiliary power unit, to maintain hydraulic pressure and provide some flight control. The pilots now had two controls available to direct their aircraft: the rudders to control their yaw, or left-right direction, and the one cable-controlled instrument on the aircraft, their trim tab. The trim tab is a small tab or mini flap which is part of the rear elevator. It gave them some elevator control, or the nose-up and nose-down pitch of the plane.
"We have the airspeed to get to OIA," Landry said. "The hydraulics are responding but sluggish."
"That's the RAT kicking in," Stillwagon replied. "Our airspeed is down to 190, and we are approaching 2,500 feet. The only three controls that were still functional without electricity were the airspeed, the altimeter, and the altitude, or horizon. Kevin could see his speed, how high he was, and if the wings were level with the ground. That was it.
"We can't risk the airport," Stillwagon stated. "It's pushing our glide path limits. That crosswind won't let us stay on track either. It's at least 25 knots. We don't have the rudder control to compensate. We'll drift left into wherever the crosswind pushes us."
"Then what the fuck do you want to do?" Landry replied. The captain scanned the landscape in front of him. They were following a major roadway directly under their wings. The 6-lane road ran directly to the airport, but at rush hour, the roadway was full of cars and trucks. A quick look down showed a full thoroughfare, and as he continued to scan for some field or body of water to touch down into, he could swear that the cars were all stopped on the street, even the ones that weren't at a traffic light.
"No time for that now. Off to the southwest," Kevin noted two large bodies of water that would handle an emergency landing.
He did a lot of quick math in his head and determined that Lake Conway was likely their best bet to set the aircraft down without creating any additional damage or deaths. First and foremost, Kevin was responsible for the over 150 souls in his plane, but he couldn't risk killing more innocents if putting his plane down had little chance of saving his passengers while hurting others on the ground. If no legitimate option became available, Captain Stillwagon would find a field or spot where he would do the least damage and point his nose into the ground, minimizing collateral damage. It was a horrible situation to be in.
"Over there," Kevin pointed to his counterpart. "Aim to those two bodies of water. It's into the crosswind and within 5 miles. "You sure about this?" Landry said back. Fear could be heard in his voice, and Kevin couldn't blame him for it. He was about to piss his own pants, but as captain, he couldn't have the option of showing any hesitation or dread.
"Yeah," Kevin replied. "I'll take us in. Just line me up while I inform the passengers and crew."
Kevin picked up a telephone that was directly wired into the passenger cabin.
It wasn't connected to any computers or other switches. He keyed the microphone and spoke to the souls riding behind him.
"This is the captain speaking,"
the speakers blared to the horrified tourists. When the lights went out in the plane, even the most white-knuckled travelers accepted the first few seconds. But when several people noticed that the engine noise had stopped, pandemonium erupted. It had been less than 30 seconds since the plane died, and terror had already set in.
"We have lost all power to the aircraft," he continued. "This is a red emergency. We have 60 seconds to get ready. Flight attendants, prepare for ditching."
Kevin had informed the flight attendants that there was a red emergency. It was one of three emergency landings that he could have announced. The first was a medical emergency, which is self-explanatory. The second is a yellow emergency, which indicated the aircraft was somewhat disabled, but that no injuries or damage was expected. The third emergency was a red emergency. That meant all bets were off and to expect damage to the aircraft and possible injury or death. The fact that he informed them that he was ditching meant a water landing. Finally, he told them to expect this all to happen in about 60 seconds. The attendants unstrapped themselves from their jump seats and rushed down the aisles, commanding everyone to stay seated and get into a crash position. Children started crying and screaming, their theme park visit turning into a nightmare none of them could comprehend. Adult responses ran the gamut of being fearfully calm while organizing their family, to outright screaming and crying as their imminent death seemed to be hurtling at them. Kevin took control of the aircraft, adjusting the trim wheel and handling the foot pedals to keep the gliding behemoth on course for the two bodies of water in front of him. Lake Conway and its sister, Little Lake Conway, sat ahead. With the 25-knot wind gusting in his face, his airspeed began to taper off.
"I'm reading 170 knots, Landry said. "We're at 1,800 feet and descending."
"Countdown from 1,000, Kevin shot back. "Let me know when we reach 130 knots.
With a water landing, Captain Stillwagon had to keep his landing gear up. If he was to attempt an emergency landing on solid ground, dropping the landing gear would give him some last-minute speed reduction and a bit more control over where he set down. But if the gear were dropped now, it would grab the water and flip the aircraft over and likely break the plane into pieces.
"Are those lakes long enough to bring us down?" Landry asked.
The A320 needs a minimum of 6,000 feet of runway to land, and the lakes in front of them look to be just short of that, at least in the direction they were traveling.
"They are not quite a mile wide, but we don't need that much for a water landing," Kevin replied. 500 yards should get us down and floating."
The A320, when brought down intact and under control, could float for almost an hour. Chelsea Burnett, Sully Sullenberger, had done an identical maneuver in the Hudson River back in 2009. His U.S. Air Flight 1549 Airbus A320 floated long enough that the only injury or damage any of the passengers suffered was wet shoes as they walked off the wing of the aircraft into the emergency boats that had been dispatched. Kevin loved that story and was grateful that he had a chance of repeating Sully's miracle on the Hudson. If only his airspeed could hold out, they could have a chance at walking away from the mess they were in.
"Airspeed down to 130, boss," the first officer said.
"Damn," Kevin replied.
"That headwind is knocking us down hard."
"Altitude 1,000, Tyler replied. Kevin watched his airspeed rapidly bleed away. They were coming up in the southern lake, Lake Conway, and it was going to be close, real close. The ground and trees were rapidly coming up to meet them. Sitting at the front of the metal missile he had control over just a minute ago used to be exhilarating. Now, with minimal control,
The windshield seemed little protection, and watching the landscape rapidly expand and rush up to meet him made him regret the panoramic view he was seeing.
"I don't think we're going to make it," the co-pilot shouted.
Kevin had just a few seconds left, and the trees were coming up at him more quickly than he had hoped. It was looking more and more like they were going to come up short.
500 feet, Perkins said solemnly. 400, 350, 300, 250, 200.
As the final seconds ticked away, Kevin could see that the tree line was going to get to them before the water. The headwind was strong, and their airspeed had gone down rapidly. He checked his trim wheel and found he had a bit more he could drop it. He spun the wheel drum back, dropping the trim tab down as far as it could go, raising the nose of the aircraft a few more feet. He had done all he could, and as the altimeter read 100, he saw that they were just short. The treetops loomed in front of him, rushing at the window like a freight train. He said a quick prayer and thought of his wife and daughter. They weren't going to make it. Lake Conway Estates. Jorge loved his house. Raised in Orlando by a poor Mexican immigrant family, his father had a small landscape company, and his mother worked housekeeping at Disney World. He grew up in a large Catholic family with 4 brothers and 3 sisters. With the help of their church, they all went to St. John Vianney Catholic School. Private high school was financially out of the question, so the 8 children all attended Oak Ridge High School, where he excelled in both baseball and academics, taking AP classes in English, calculus, and psychology. Jorge was one of 7 out of 8 siblings to get a bachelor's degree or higher. He attended Rollins College in Winter Park on a partial baseball scholarship, just a few miles from where he grew up in southeast Orlando. He worked his way through school, getting jobs bussing tables and cutting lawns. It was hard work, but like most students that had to work for their education, he rose to the top of his abilities. Jorge walked out of college with a degree from one of the finest business schools in the southeast United States. Within 8 years, he had risen to vice president of an international bank, where his finance degree brought him a well-deserved position and salary. Today, Jorge Vasquez walked out onto the deck of his house that overlooked Lake Conway. He had purchased the home earlier that year from a foreclosure list at the bank, and now, at 30 years old, he stood next to the lake, drinking a well-deserved beer, proudly looking over the backyard where a boy from poor Mexican immigrants had made it to a level that his parents could not even dream of. He thought of the years at Rollins where rich kids from rich parents sent their children to get a rich man's education. It was a ticket into a club where the wealthy took care of each other. The education was top-notch, and the company he kept was thick with money and prestige. Jorge never really fit in with most of them. Not that they weren't nice enough to him, but there was always an undercurrent to their relationships. When your classmates were named Chip, Matt, and Craig, the name Jorge never really seemed to fit. But Jorge didn't hate them. It just all seemed too easy for his fellow classmates. It's not like it was their fault being born into wealth, but Jorge knew he deserved to be where he was. He had earned it. With the stock market closing at 4 p.m., Jorge slipped out of the office after finishing his reports. His drive to the new house took less than 20 minutes. He relaxed with a cold beer, thinking about tonight's plans. He was meeting his latest girlfriend, Maria. She was the first Latino he had dated since graduating from college. His dark complexion, deep brown eyes, and athletic physique really got him any woman he wanted. The past 8 or 9 years found him with various girlfriends, all of which you could classify as wealthy and blonde. Maria, on the other hand, was from a family his parents knew. Jorge had decided to get serious about his private life. The idea of having a wife and children were now starting to poke at his subconscious mind. His mother had been bugging him for years, but, like many things in life, it all came down to timing. Now was the time, as far as Jorge was concerned. His co-workers were mostly married, and a couple of his fellow vice presidents were working on their first kids. Maria, to date, had been everything he could ask for and more. Tonight, they were going to dine downtown with couples from his bank. It was to be the first introduction Maria would have into his business life. He knew she'd be a hit. She was intelligent and successful, just like Jorge. As he gazed over the water, there was a growing feeling of something Jorge just couldn't quite comprehend. The thought or an awareness was gnawing at him that things were wrong. He pulled his phone out of his pocket to look at the time, and he saw that it had died. "Damn," he said to the phone. "I thought I charged you." Jorge turned to go back into his house when he felt a presence descend over him. In a flash, he could feel a pressure that was overwhelming. He realized, suddenly, that the world was eerily quiet, almost like a tomb. In a fraction of a second, his athletic instincts told him that something was dramatically wrong. He remembered the same feeling from high school. Although a standout in baseball, Jorge played football as a defensive back. Once he remembered defending the opponent's wide receiver on a deep fly route to the end zone. There was a moment when he heard the crowd roar and he knew that the ball was in the air and coming his way. And he now had that same sinking feeling. That's when he knew something was wrong. There was no noise. Nothing at all. Normally, cars could be heard whisking along the road nearby. The only sounds he heard now was a lone mockingbird blasting out its call. Then, a building presence of what he could only describe as a wave of air began to quickly grow, and a low, deep rumble was coming from the front of his new home. Jorge stood looking at the back of his house, wondering what could possibly make such a deep and frightening noise, when he saw the nose of a huge jet plane cresting over his roofline. It enveloped the sky above him as it majestically crossed over his head, seemingly touching the top of his house. He could almost reach up and brush the bottom of the aircraft as it passed over his head and dropped out of the sky. He was too stunned to move as the magnificent beast blasted through the vegetation behind his beautiful lakefront home. Just as quickly as it passed overhead, the jumbo jet was through the copse of the trees that lined the water, gliding toward the opposite side of the lake. The engines hanging from each wing miraculously cut through the live oaks that hugged the edge of the water, cutting a swath of small branches and leaves and leaving behind a hole in the canopy above. Jorge ran to the water's edge as the enormous metal bird slowly descended towards the surface of the lake. It was a sight he would never forget, especially since he didn't know if the beast would come down in time to avoid smashing into the homes on the opposite shore. Delta Flight 2181. Captain Stillwagon could hardly believe it. His jet passed through the canopy of trees and was lined up to settle down onto the lake underneath him. The big bird kept gliding over the water, seemingly afraid to touch the glassy surface. Kevin began to worry that he was overshooting the lake and would pancake the plane and all aboard into the houses on the rapidly approaching shoreline. "Kevin!" the first officer shouted, pointing to the opposite shore. "I know," he shouted back. Captain Stillwagon spun his trim wheel forward, lowering the nose of the plane. It was a delicate maneuver. If he dipped too low, the nose of the craft would bury itself into the water and the tail would flip over in a somersault maneuver that would, at the least, place the plane upside down. At the worst, and most likely, the plane would break apart. The nose of the jet dipped toward the water. its nose-down position dropping the jet more rapidly than before.
"Running out of room!" Landry shouted. "Half a mile to the shore!"
Kevin flew by feel, finally spinning the trim wheel back when he felt that the jet was ready to settle into the lake. As the nose started to rise, the plane contacted the water. First, it skipped a bit, until it settled enough to have the engines grab and drag them to a rapid stop. From contact with the water to its final position floating in the lake, the jet traveled just over 300 yards, about half the normal emergency stopping distance seen on land. The passengers and crew had been thrown forward when the engines caught the water, but the incessant screaming by the flight attendants to bend over and keep your heads down had resulted in most passengers having little more than a black and blue mark across their waists. Kevin exhaled. He realized he hadn't taken a breath for the past minute. He looked back to his right to examine the wings. The craft was floating. As he was looking out the right, Landry leapt from his seat and stared out his left side window and began to laugh.
"Check it out, Skipper," he giggled
as he pointed out the left side of the windshield.
"Tell the flight attendant to have them depart the plane on the left."
Kevin leaned over to his co-pilot's side and smiled. The left wing was there, butting up against a dock that sat on the northern shore of the lake. The passengers were already flowing out onto the wing, the emergency exit having been opened. The first of his souls tiptoed out onto the wooden dock and waved back at the cockpit. Kevin closed his eyes and said a prayerful thanks. First Officer Landry opened the door to the cockpit as Kevin got on the overhead phone.
"Ladies and gentlemen, this is the termination of Flight 2181, LaGuardia to Orlando. Please exit out the left side emergency door and make your way to the dock at the end of the wing. This is Captain Stillwagon thanking you for flying Delta Airlines."
The cabin erupted in a deafening cheer. Landry looked back at Kevin and smiled.
"Nice job, Sully."
The two of them waited for the passengers to disembark the plane, making sure to check the aircraft before leaving themselves. They were the last people off the ship. All were ashore within 10 minutes, but were confronted with yet another problem. No one had a working cell phone. Kevin smiled and patted Tyler on the shoulder.
"What a day," he said. "At least the worst is over."
Little did he know.